Eh, Akahele, if you haven't seen Chief of War episode 4, this is your spoiler alert. Also, if you want to skip the recap, go to 3-minute, 30-second mark. Mahalo for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode of Feathers and Fire.
You are listening to Feathers and Fire, HPR's Chief of War After Show podcast. Thanks so much for joining us for deeper discussion and additional context to the Apple TV Plus series. I'm Russell Subiono.
Aloha mai, and I'm Mehana Makainai. Today we'll be discussing Episode 4, House of Flowers, Part 2. Our main topic, the transfer of power and kukailimoku to Kiowa and Kamehameha from Kalaniopuu. And Ka'ahumanu and a look at the English language and Christianity in Hawaii. We'll also get some insight with UH alumni, kalo farmer, olelo Hawaii practitioner, business owner, community activist, hoiva'a coach, phew, and of course, actor who portrays Kamehameha Paiea and Chief of Wars, Kaina Makua. Before we get into these discussions, Russell and I have your episode recap, and I must say, Russell, your predictions have been spot on, most notably in the episode, The Love Affair That Has Begun Between Kupuohi and Namake. Oh my goodness, the drama.
Oh, Kupuohi, you're breaking my heart. Come on. We start with the news of the death of Hawaii Island's king, Kalaniopuu. That emboldens Kahekili, who continues to strengthen his grip on Oahu and now readies to invade Hawaii Island. We then get a scene at a river where we see how Kupuohi and Namake have started to grow closer, much to the chagrin of his brother Nahi, who still believes that Kaiana is alive. We then return to Zamboanga, where Vai has secured the guns for Kaiana. We see Kaiana searching the marketplace, looking for Tony, who went missing at the end of the last episode. Kaiana then gets himself in some trouble and becomes a target of the port's authorities.
Back on Hawaii Island, a succession ceremony has started to confirm the new king. Kalaniopuu's son, Keoua, is named Ali'i Nui, but stewardship of the war god Kukailimoku is given to Kamehameha, enraging Kiowa and causing a rift amongst the chiefs of the kingdom. This is a huge deal that we'll talk more about after the recap.
Then we get this great scene of Kamehameha and Ka'ahumanu at the Naha Stone, which is the stone Kamehameha had lifted to show he was the prophesied one. We'll talk about why this was a pivotal scene for the series later. Kamehameha tells his chiefs and advisors that he expects Keoua to attack, but they will not launch a preemptive attack. Instead, they will prepare for Keoua's attack and defend themselves. Then we cut back to Zamboanga, where the guns have been loaded on the ship and the captain and Vi are ready to sail off, but Kaiana is nowhere to be found. And that's because he's looking for Tony amongst the holding pens for slaves. And we see Kaiana open all the cages, setting everyone free. He does eventually find Tony and helps him back to the dock, where they are able to get on the ship bound for Hawaii. The episode ends back on Hawaii Island with Kupuohi entering the Make's hale at night, no longer being able to fight her feelings as she kisses him.
Oh, it's getting hot and much more complicated. Now, speaking of complicated, let's get into our first topic. Yep. The transfer of power and kukailimoku to Kiowa and Kamehameha, respectively, from Kalaniopuu. When it comes to the passing of Kalaniopuu, anytime halake kahi ali'i, it was a big deal, followed by numerous events, such as a period of mourning, specific ceremonies, the naming of an heir or heirs, and a kalai aina, or redivision of lands by the new chief. We didn't have land ownership in traditional society, but we did have land affinity. As far as I know, most new chiefs would keep land boundaries pretty similar to how they originally were, so oftentimes this was more of a formality. However, it did provide the opportunity for new designations to be made, showcasing a shift in power, or as a way of recognizing alliances or even identifying adversaries. In the episode, after the death of Kalaniopuu, his kuleana, his roles, his responsibilities, were divided between his son Keoua and his nephew Kamehameha. Some background. Typically, the right to rule went hand in hand with the right to the war god. Because, I mean, think about it, Russell, right? If you're the ruler and you go into battle, do you want the war god on your team?
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely. It's imperative. Because whoever has the war god is always victorious. They wouldn't call Kuka'ilimoku the snatcher of islands if he lost in battle. So most often, again, these kuleana went together. In our past, when there was this type of division, in my opinion, it signified a ruler honoring one person while also setting up another person to eventually take over. Makes for a great storyline, right?
Yeah, and I love this scene because of the conflict it creates. And this conflict goes deep. But it's not just between the man Keo'ua and the man Kamehameha. It's a conflict between highborn and lowborn, privileged and not privileged. This rift between factions will have rippling effects on every district and community that each of these factions touches. Something I imagine we'll see unfold as the series goes on. We can see how more embers of war are starting to get fanned. And as I'm watching this, I'm thinking, man, Kalani Opu'u knows his son's character. Why did he antagonize him like this, splitting power between his son and Kamehameha? So I'm wondering, did this actually happen? Did Kalani Opu'u divide his power and kuleana up like this?
The answer is, as far as we know, yes, wow, he did. But it was actually between his son Kivala'o and his nephew Kamehameha. Some say issues developed as Kivala'o did not give Kamehameha his fair share of lands in the Kalai'aina that we just talked about. It's also said that Kamehameha overstepped his role in ceremonies dedicated to the recently passed Kalaniopuu. Kivala'o was also likely upset that his cousin inherited custodianship over the war god, like you mentioned in the scene where it's depicted with Keo'ua and Kamehameha. So these two, they definitely had their beef, for sure. And eventually, in the Battle of Moku'ohai in 1782, Kivala'o is killed. So I believe that Kalani Opu'u foresaw this happening and ultimately wanted Kamehameha to be the ruler. It wasn't because he didn't love his son or think his son was maybe a good person or in a good position, but he understood that difficult times were coming and you have to make a choice as a ruler in the best interests of your people and the land. And Kamehameha was probably seen as that best choice, which is why he was given custodianship over the war god. Kalani Opu'u, we know historically, was very close to Kamehameha. He trained him. With Kamehameha, they met Europeans for the first time. He was by his side. Kamehameha fought in battles for and with Kalani Opu'u. He was known to be a great warrior. So really, in that context, it all makes sense. Now, after the death of Kivala'o, historically, Kamehameha turns his attention to Maui because Kahekili Nui Ahumanu has been making headway in his conquests of the other islands. So Kamehameha, with his warriors, as well as a number of foreign advisors, including Isaac Davis and John Young, began battling with the Maui chiefs and earning some renowned victories. But meanwhile, while that's going on, back on Hawaii Island, Keo'ua Ku'ahu'ula, this Keo'ua that is being shown as this main character in Chief of War, he's the younger brother of the slain Kivala'o, and we start to see him making his own claim to areas in Hawaii and his own kind of move towards power and unrest. So Kamehameha has to return to Hawaii and deal with his cousin now. That's an abbreviated history, but you get the idea, right? So I'm thinking that this series, Chief of War, has decided to cut out Kivala'o away, poor Kivala'o, but for simplicity and maybe kind of wrap the story of Kivala'o and Keo'ua into one character. But we'll have to keep watching to be sure.
And just for clarification, historically, Kivala'o and Keo'ua, the brothers, the two sons of Kalani Opu'u, for Chief of War in this context, they've kind of put the characters together, right? Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing is Keo'ua in Chief of War, but in history, in the historical context, there were actually two sons
for
and Kalani Opu'u.
It might kind of drive historians crazy, right? They might be like, oh, what's going on here? But I think for viewers, it's a little easier to follow. And this is why we've been saying all along, don't use Chief of War as your history lesson. Yeah. But there are actual characters and events that are shown. So use it to dig deeper.
Also, I want to say that the fact that Kamehameha had to historically fend off would-be usurpers left and right, I don't know if it's like, you know, shout out Kamehameha for being able to handle it or be like, oh man, that's way too much work for me. Just concentrate on my island or on just my ahupua.
Stay in our lane. Yeah. Stay in our lane. That was a really big topic. Let's do another one. That being Ka'ahumanu and a look at the English language and Christianity. So, Russell, you've told us before in this podcast that you grew up going to church and learned about Ka'ahumanu. What can you share with us about the stories and histories you've been presented with?
What I remember the most is that the church is very proud of the fact that Ka'ahumanu converted to Christianity and led the dismantling of the kapu system that, among other things, forbid men and women to share meals in public, forbid women to eat certain types of food, and whose religious focus was on deities in the forms of idols, which directly violates the Ten Commandments. And so I grew up with this perspective of who Ka'ahumanu is. The church sees Ka'ahumanu as an ally historically.
Let's look at some of those things you just stated. You know, that the church very much is proud of how she converted to Christianity and dismantled the kapu system. And I think a lot of times it's kind of presented that way, but truthfully, she actually dismantled the kapu system prior to the arrival of the missionaries and to deciding to convert to Christianity. So I think sometimes it seems like maybe Christianity influenced her, but in my studies, I feel like actually she had already done this and decided to part ways with the kapu system. And then when Christianity arrived formally, she ended up researching it and deciding that maybe this should be the good path for her and for her people. Now that kind of changed our narrative a little, right? Yeah. And then you mentioned things like, you know, women being forbidden from eating certain foods. And a lot of times that's talked about in the kapu system because the name is a kapu sacred eating. Dr. Lirikala Kame'elehiwa, who's one of my mentors and an incredible storyteller at UH Manoa, right? And she writes and talks a lot about this subject and how the reason women gave up certain foods, and remember, Papa Hanaumoku agreed to this. Mm-hmm. It wasn't that women were told, but is because the foods they gave up represented male mana. And we believe that when you eat something, you control it and it becomes a part of you. So it was actually a way to kind of create that division and boundary between male kuleana and female kuleana. And I think a lot of people maybe get kind of hung up on that today, but I don't think it was as big a deal. That's just my perspective. Other historians might be like, no, it was a big deal. But in what I saw and learned, I feel like a couple really created a pono, a balance. And men and women had specific kuleana that sometimes they did separately and sometimes they did together. And I don't know, but I do like having a good meal with my girlfriend sometimes. So I don't mind not having all the men around. And the men did all the cooking. So if you're going to tell me, give up certain foods, the men will do all the cooking and preparing and they'll feed you women in your own hale and you get to enjoy time with the women and young children, I'd be like, yes, please. Yeah. You know, sign me up. So kind of good to think about it from maybe those different perspectives, right? Yeah. For me, what I've learned about and been exposed to in regards to Ka'ahumanu was that she was a very strong-minded, powerful woman, which I think the church presents as well, right?
Yeah.
And she was also kind of like a side note, she was considered very tall by some accounts, like maybe 6 feet. So she had this presence, right, that was largely known and well-respected in Hawaii amongst Hawaiian people as well as newcomers when they were arriving. Many, including myself, believe a principal reason for her pulling away from Hawaiian spirituality, which again actually happened before the arrival of the missionaries and led to her abolishment of the kapu system, was likely the population collapse that was going on. This was unfolding in Hawaii during her lifetime due to introduced diseases. And to put the severity of it in perspective, by the time of the arrival of the missionaries, we may have already lost 80% of our population.
Wow, I didn't realize that had happened at that point in time.
Right? Wow. And that's like, we're talking about a period of maybe only about 40 years or so, 80% of your population. That is catastrophic.
Yeah.
So imagine all of the grief and confusion that was going on in society. To say she lived through a chaotic time, a devastating time, an unprecedented time is an understatement, right? And this most likely had a huge impact on her religious beliefs and made her question deeply why the gods had forsaken us.
Yeah, because if Hawaiians are dying by the hundreds and thousands, with no answer from the gods, then I could see how she would ultimately lose faith.
I mean, think about how our problems handled, and even today, how we handle problems, very similar, right? You look to past experiences, you look to your spirituality, to your religion, you look to, like when we're talking about sicknesses, your doctors, or in Hawaii, our kahuna la'o lapa'o, but none of the traditional answers were working at this time. And so change was inevitable and needed.
We do see her character in Chief of War feeling very ignored and abandoned by the gods. So there's already kind of this internal spiritual vacuum inside of herself, and she eventually creates it externally because when she dismantles the Kapu system, it does make it easier for Christian missionaries to fill that role as her and maybe some others are looking for more spiritual answers.
Yeah, and I mean, think about it. Hawaiians were very spiritual people. Mm-hmm. We recognized, you know, 400,000 different gods, a god for every place, every need, every desire. And when that is removed, you have a huge, as you said, void. Yeah. And you have spiritual people looking for solutions, looking for an answer. And lo and behold, the missionaries show up. And even if they didn't have all of the answers, they presented something. They said, we have olaho, we've got this, you know, do these things and you can live like we are, because we're not dying in huge numbers. So I think for people like Kaahumanu and others, that was very attractive and it was worth a chance. Now, going back a little more into her history, Kaahumanu actually, like you mentioned, before she became a Christian, was regarded as very devout to her identity as a Hawaiian woman and the roles she assumed. Since many people think of her as someone who heavily influenced abolishment of the traditional system of living, it may be surprising to these people that before she made these types of decisions, she actually served as kuhina nui, or lead spiritual advisor, not Christian spiritual advisor, but Hawaiian spiritual advisor, not only to Kamehameha the Great, but also to Liholiho Kamehameha the Second, and then Kauikioli Kamehameha the Third. So impressive. She was declared a pu'uhonua, or a place of refuge, by Kamehameha I. We often hear about physical spaces that were places of refuge, but Kaahumanu as a person served that function.
I didn't even know that was possible.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was her. And that's a title Kamehameha bestowed upon her. So she was the city of refuge in and of herself. So I do kind of wish that Chief of War showed more of this steadfast leader that I've always interpreted Kaahumanu as being, opposed to sometimes, like you mentioned, kind of unsure, oftentimes pushed aside by the men. With that being said, I do think that Luciani Buchanan is doing a beautiful job of playing this vulnerable and inquisitive woman who seems to have this fire stirring inside her. And I also believe those were attributes Kaahumanu did possess. And perhaps looking ahead, maybe Chief of War is setting her up to have a triumphant moment, right? So they're changing her story a little bit. They're speeding things up a little bit, but they're going to maybe bring in other elements of the character that many of us have found in her as we've learned about history. And to me, the development of this character comes off a bit more with a Western approach and worldview of women versus like a Hawaiian approach to women. The whole conversation with John Young kind of like exudes that.
That's interesting that you bring up that the character comes off as a bit more of a Western approach. I think that has a lot to do with the style of storytelling that we're all used to in this day and age is a Western style of storytelling, right? And so there are these foundational and kind of formulaic ways that we have to tell stories in order for them to make sense or for us to be able to receive them in a certain way. And I totally get your disappointment with the way that Kaahumanu was written. But I happen to think that she's on this really great character arc that will ultimately elevate her to the level through which you view her, and I think a lot of others view her, and maybe will ultimately view her. All great characters go through these journeys over the course of epic stories like this, right? Think about like Tony Stark in the Marvel movies. He's Iron Man. He goes from self-centered rich weapons manufacturer to making the ultimate sacrifice. Or think about Elphaba in Wicked. Huge movie last year, right? She goes from shy and reticent to becoming the Wicked Witch of the West. So I think what we're seeing is Kaahumanu being first portrayed as unsure of herself and unquestionably compliant to the authorities in her life. But through episode 2 and 3, we start to see little changes along the way. She's gaining confidence. She's taking more control over her life. There's this great scene in this episode where she literally and symbolically leaves the women working on Kappa to talk to her father, Keaomoku. Kaahumanu suggests that she can talk to Kamehameha about why he needs to face Keaua's threat, and Keaomoku tells her, no, I'll take care of it.
Kamehameha does not understand why he must face this threat.
I can speak with him.
Your place is with the wives.
You brought me here to help Kamehameha.
But not now. Go with the women. I will see to this.
But she goes and talks to him anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's the first time we see her go against her father's wishes or her father's instructions. And then in the very next scene where she's talking to Kamehameha at the Naha Stone, we see her take her first steps as advisor and confidant to Kamehameha. And I feel like this is a pivotal scene where the tide starts to turn for the portrayal of this character.
And I do think the vulnerability and how they're showing her, I do think those absolutely relate to Kaahumanu and things she was dealing with. And I hope, like you said, that that's what's happening. It's for more of the storytelling in this series way of building her up, mm-hmm. as opposed to releasing all of her characteristics right away that maybe we know her to be or we appreciate or we expect her to be.
We're almost seeing the opposite in Kupuohi, right? Where she's very strong and now she's weak and she can't wait for Kaiana. Oh,
no, I don't think she's weak. I think that you're just so mad that she has had this love affair with Namake. But I'm like, girl waited for him for a year. She's been so tough about that. And you know what? Like, can I wait forever? Doesn't mean she doesn't still love him. Anyway, back to Kaahumanu a little bit more. When it comes to Christianity and the English language, as we've already said, Kaahumanu was an early convert to Christianity. In fact, one of our most renowned scholars, Kamakau, wrote about her being the first fruit of Kauaiha'o Church and the first to accept the word of God. So when missionaries arrived in 1820, Kaahumanu befriended them. And so Chief of War kind of is speeding this up with her relationship with John Young and befriending and learning English and learning about different religion, things like that, right? When the missionaries arrived in 1820, it took her a while to convert to Christianity. This didn't really happen until 1825, you know, quite a bit after the death of Kamehameha and the abolishment of the kapu system. You know, Kaahumanu was this powerful woman who lived through immense trauma in Hawaii and made very difficult and long-lasting decisions for our people. While I may not always agree with the decisions she made, she was in a really hard position and she was an ali'i. And what is the role of an ali'i? To malama aina and malama kanaka. And I do believe she did her best to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's take a break. We'll be right back.
Velina mai kako. This is Paige Okamura, DJ Mermaid, meke kono a ke aloha, to join me every Sunday evening for an exploration into Hawaiian music from the past to the present, where we'll dive into the artists, composers, lyrics, and mo'olelo that make up the rich tapestry of Hawaiian music. That's Hawaii Kula Iwi, every Sunday from 6 to 7, here on HBR One.
Let's get into the categories. Most impactful or chicken skin moment?
Okay, so mine's... I particularly enjoyed the opening and closing scenes, the beginning and the end. The opening scene with the kūkini running to inform the Kohala chiefs that Kaleni Opu'u has died. Even though it's shot in Kualoa, that's okay. Eo o ahu, right? Such a cool scene. Kūkini were our messengers and they ran across islands with important news to share. So this scene set the stage for big changes that are coming and potential hardships ahead. With the closing scene, I know this scene it's raw for you. It's a hard one.
Still hurts.
Kupuohi gives in to Namake and decides to be with him. Meanwhile, we know Kaiana is headed home. Oh, life's dilemmas. She waited for him for a year and finally decided to move on, not knowing that Kaiana is headed her way. So,
My most impactful moment was when Kaiana is in Zamboanga in the marketplace looking for Tony. and he hears a kid crying beneath this covering. And when he lifts it up, he sees that child and a whole bunch of other people locked in a cage. And the look on Katyana's face is, this is so wrong. How can anybody do this? And the camera dwells on Jason Momoa's face for a bit. And in those seconds, I think he does a really great job of showing us not just his abhorrence of what's going on, but also maybe even a little guilt over all the death and torture he may have caused in the past. And it's another moment of a Jason Momoa character being vulnerable, and it's refreshing to see that from an actor who's so well known for like the ferocity of his characters.
And then I love his response, because he turns around and he just false cracks that guy. And then he sets everyone free, basically, right? Yeah. He finds a way to go help people.
Next category, character that brought the most heat or the performance that we really liked.
I'm going to go with Kamehameha, Kainamakua. He's had his largest role in this episode so far in the series. I'm guessing in each subsequent episode, his importance will continue to grow. And I think that he's set a very strong foundation for his character. He calmly refuses to give in to Kiowa's demand for Kuka'ili Moku. He discusses the Naha Stone with Ka'ahumanu, and they have a breakthrough with one another. He tells his community that essentially if war comes to them, they will respond and defeat Kiowa. He portrays Kamehameha as being very well collected, willing to listen to advisors, but also prepared to follow his own path. And as someone who ultimately wants people on land to be cared for and peace to prevail in Hawaii, I think a lot of what Kaina's brought to the role and the development of scenes for this character connects to characteristics that many of us believe were likely present in the Ali'i.
Yeah. For me, I want to say it's still Te Ao o Hinepehinga as Kupu'ohi. Takes a lot of acting skill to have that much restraint and then finally give in. But since she's in my doghouse at the moment, I'm choosing somebody else. I really liked Cliff Curtis and his work as Kilauea in this episode. He's one of my favorite actors of all time because he's so good at really disappearing into his characters. He does it probably most expertly in Training Day, where he plays a Mexican gangster.
No, that's why I never shake his hand, Holmes. He don't respect nada. You know what the money's for? Alonzo, he's a hothead. Last week in Vegas, some Russian starts talking shit. Alonzo, he just snapped.
And Cliff Curtis isn't playing one of the headlining historical characters, but he's bringing fire to every frame that Kilauea is in.
I like that you chose him because one of the things that stands out to me with his portrayal is I love how he speaks Hawaiian by putting in like the T sounds. Did you notice that?
Yeah, I noticed he has that little tweak to the way he speaks.
Yeah. You know, that might have just been because of maybe he's new to Hawaiian and maybe with his Maori language experience, right? Maybe that was just kind of something that happened. Maybe it was a deliberate decision. I'm not sure. But I liked it because we do know that on our islands, while we spoke the same language, we had different dialects. Mm-hmm. So it kind of showcases that, right? And I enjoyed it.
I love what he's bringing to the character for sure.
Yeah, but I'm also kind of upset with you, Russell, that you would you would be like, it would have been Te Ao Hinepehinga as Kupu'ohi, but you know what? I'm mad at her because can I get mad at her for what she did? She made that choice.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. Ultimately, you know, it's been a year.
Why
you know.
Women always got to get in trouble? You know what? Yeah, Katyana, you should have hurried up and got home sooner.
Yeah, you're right. Next category, most questionable moment or the moment that raised questions or the moment that needs more explanation.
I'm going to go with the scene on the heio where out of frustration, Kiowa begins bashing his cheek in with his fist.
Yes.
Yeah. Until his mouth bleeds and he pulls out a tooth. I'm assuming this is a play on mourning traditions. It's been recorded that sometimes out of grief, our ancestors would inflict physical pain and damage to themselves as a way of perhaps letting out their emotions, and even carrying a physical scar to showcase their affection for the person who passed and how it changed them. But Kiowa with this self-mutilation was done out of anger because he was upset that Kamehameha was given custodianship over the war god. So it was a bit questionable for me.
Yeah, it really freaked me out. It kind of came out of nowhere. When my grandma died, my uncles and aunties said that the way Hawaiians process grief was by cutting their hair or pulling out teeth. And it didn't make any sense to me. Maybe I still need to learn more about it. But coincidentally enough, I had had an extra tooth pulled prior to my grandma's funeral, and I brought it home to show my mom, not knowing that it was also a funeral tradition. So when my family gathered items to put in an umeke to anchor to the bottom of the ocean where she had pilina to, I put my tooth in there.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I put my tooth in there, and then me and a bunch of cousins and my uncle, we paddled out off the coast of Kauai High, and we anchored that umeke down at the bottom of the water in a symbolic way, because ultimately what my grandfather wanted was that when he passed, that their ashes would be spread together. Mm. So it was more symbolic than an actual burial or an actual ceremony. That was how I connected to that particular
wow.
scene.
Wow. Yeah. Well, your scene is really beautiful. Oh. And thank you for sharing yeah. that.
All right. Our favorite, or maybe our listeners' favorite, definitely our CEO's favorite, the Meredith Hartley Most Momoa moment.
The scene where Kaiana is searching for Tony and kicks everyone's butt yeah. in the human trafficking holding area complex oh. village, whatever that place was. He's cutting open gates with his knife very dramatically. He's taking people out left and right. And ultimately, he's the hero that saves Tony. If that ain't a Momoa moment, I don't know what is.
It would have been more of a Momoa moment if he did it in a malo, though.
Did it in pants. Yeah. I know, he's starting to like those pants. I'm not yeah, sure about that.
A little bit too much. There's this other scene that I thought was classic Momoa. He's talking to Vi, and they're walking around the Zamboanga marketplace, and he's like really pressing on her. He's asking her how she got there, saying he sees no kanaka in her, and that the way she acts probably would be discussed among the chiefs back home. They're both exasperated with each other, but they know they need each other for their future. And then Kaiana asks if she's seen Tony, and Vi says, not today, and walks away. And Kaiana lets out this frustrated grunt. It's like, "Sha,
I made the deal for your guns. We must take them to your ship.
Have you seen Tony?
Not today.
He has to come with me.
I'm sure he's fine, Kaiana.
And that seems like a very Momoa moment to me. And I get the sense that it was an improvised moment, and I really liked it. What prop or artifact would you want from this episode?
I would like the pohaku that plays the Naha Stone in this episode. I have the perfect place for that pohaku in my yard. Uh-huh. If you would like to come and live with me, ehele mai ke oleolu. Most of us grew up with the story of Kamehameha moving the impenetrable Naha Stone, a huge feat that helped him to secure his support amongst the people and other chiefs. And Chief of War does a good job of kind of telling a little bit of that story yeah. and also doing their own little play on it. Today, that Naha Stone is in front of Hilo Library. So again, I would enjoy housing the actor who played the Naha Stone.
That's a huge stone. You're going to need like a crane and like a flatbed
yeah,
semi.
Call yeah, call you up. You need to help me carry it.
All right. I would like one of the wooden va'a. You see them on the shoreline when Kaahumanu confronts her father, Keomoku. I don't even know how I would get it around to take it out in the water. They look solid and they look really heavy. Don't think I could transport them on my little Volkswagen Tiguan. Probably got to get a heavy-duty truck with one reinforced surf rack lifted.
Tacoma.
Yeah.
2007 brand new. Cool choice.
All right. Last category, our hot take or prediction for the next episode or a series finale.
Kaiana's coming home. We're going to see him reunited with his ohana in the next episode, which I think a lot of viewers are like, he's been away too long already, right?
Yeah.
We want
yeah.
him back. Very excited for him, though technically his brother is sleeping with his wahine that you refuse to let go of, right? So I'm sure they're going to get past it, but it might be a little bit of a something.
All right. I'm processing it. I'm dealing with it. That aside, I can't believe that Kiowa would want to wait long to consolidate power by taking back Kuka'ili Moku. So I think we're going to stick with the war motif, and there will be some kind of bloody skirmish between Kiowa's army and Kamehameha's troops trying to defend their temple. Kayana is coming home and he's going to be crushed by Kupu'ohi moving on, and that will put a rift in his family. We'll see Kayana and Nahi on one side and Namaka and Kupu'ohi on the other, with Heke joining her sister because she's loyal and doesn't run off with the first guy to give her O'io.
Russell!
Just kidding. So we saw the character of Kamehameha make his debut in this series last episode, and really on the big screen as far as I know. He's played by Kauai Kalo farmer Kaina Makua, who's also making his big screen debut. And Mehana, you know him.
Yes. So Kaina and I attended Kamakakuo Kalani, the Center for Hawaiian Studies at UH Manoa together back in the day. We were also, like so many people around the time, involved in protests regarding GMO Kalo. I remember Kaina chaining the entrance shut at the School of Medicine to demonstrate against UH patents on Kalo. I haven't seen him in quite a while, but he was always very humble, very hard worker, nice to be around.
HPR's culture and arts reporter Cassie Ordonio recently got the chance to interview Kaina. Here's some of that talk story.
Going from Kalo farmer to acting, how did this role stumble upon you?
Well, 2019, I can tell you, 2019, summer of 2019, August, coaching some of our kids. I'm also a paddling coach, and Jason Momoa, he saw me on the beach coaching, invited me to his house. And at his house that night, he said, you can play Kamehameha in my show. I told him he was full of it. We had some other discussions, took some pictures. And 3 years later, he called me up and said, I told you he was going to play Kamehameha in my show. And then, you know, the rest is history. The rest we hear.
I've talked to many folks from Kauai. They always say it's such a flex. And they'll always say, like, we were never conquered the way other islands were. I mean, Kamehameha, like, failed twice trying to. I think it was through diplomacy that they reached, like, a treaty.
Yep.
And I was wondering, you know, what was the stories that you were told when you were younger, and what did you learn more through research and through this series?
So, yeah, you hear the stories of Kamehameha trying to cross Ka'i'i Oahu, which is the channel between Oahu and Kauai, and it's about 100 miles. Stories that I was told, our kupuna, or our kahuna on Kauai, was very powerful. And they would sit on these peaks, the highest peaks on Kauai, and pule and pray and oli and chant and rise, you know, make the ocean so crazy, the storm so crazy, call on all of our akua. And that's why Kamehameha had a hard time to come two times. As he made it the third time, you know, Kamuali'i, knowing that he really never have any chance, but being the ali'i that he was, so loving, you know, always thought about his people, he decided to make a treaty with Kamehameha. And interestingly enough, my question is, why would Kamehameha listen to another chief if he wanted to unify the islands? Why? No, makes sense. Because he was already winning and he beat everybody else. Why would he stop and go to peace finally? He must have learned something from Kamuali'i. He must have learned that we can still get along. You can have the kingdom, but keep my people alive. And so their relationship might have been one that I would love to sit around and just hear them talk.
In the beginning, when the casting was released, there's this blend of different Pacific Islanders, Polynesians specifically. You got Kanaka Maoli, you got Maori, Tongan, Samoan. I know some people very early when the casting came out raised concerns like, how come there's not enough Kanaka Maoli? But I was kind of wondering, how do you respond to those concerns about, you know, having those who aren't of Kanaka Maoli descent playing these historical figures?
You know, everything happened for a reason. Kuleana is Kuleana, and sometimes it sucks. But the people that understand the true meaning of Kuleana and the weight of it will see that the cast that was chosen to do these parts wasn't really chosen by Jason. Their actual being came to the people and was chosen by the actual character that they play. And if we look at it from that perspective and watch the film, everybody portrays their character, and you can feel the actual person in them through the screen. So I, you know, controversy or not, I strongly believe that the people that was chosen was meant to do the job and do their duty and their kuleana and do it right. And you can see it. They honored Hawaiian language. They honored every intricacy of what they had to portray.
The series was shot in Aotearoa. I mean, what was it like for you shooting in Aotearoa? I'm assuming it's
freaking cold. Freezing, the sand, something else. I mean, it felt like we was walking on ice some mornings, where we had to do one scene and walk on the sand at 30-something degrees. Imagine having ice on your feet, then you walk into sand. I don't know if anybody ever felt that type of cold on the sand, because we live in Hawaii, warm. But the cold definitely killed my toes. It was something else.
What is your favorite line in Chief of War?
So it's not my line. The line that I love the best, and everybody in the world will probably, especially the kids, will probably be saying this everywhere. And it's a line that Moses says, and it's in English. He tells John Young, go away.
I ask you to speak English when John Young is here.
Go away, John Young.
That's my favorite line. Because you can start to see Moses' actor and the Hawaiian society in this show start to learn English, but with a different sound. Not the sound that you're hearing now, but a sound from someone who is hearing this weird sound and trying to emulate it and say it in the same way as this white person. And so that will definitely be, I think, one of the biggest lines for the show. Go away. No, for real, go away. Nah, just kidding.
Oh, I got jokes, yeah.
Oh, I get plenty jokes, bro.
And that's it for this episode of Feathers and Fire, HPR's Chief of War After Show podcast. I'm Russell Subiono.
I'm Mehana Makainai. Thanks so much for listening. And thanks again to Kainomakua for sharing his story. This episode was written by myself and Russell and produced by Russell and Savannah Harriman-Polt.
Thanks to our incredible supporting team of Liberty Peralta, Sylvia Flores, and Sophia McCullough.
Mahalo nui to HPR's president and CEO, Meredith Artley, for the support and the critiques. She told us we didn't need to thank her at the end of every episode, but thank you anyway, Meredith.
Yeah, I ain't falling for that. Our theme song is Clarity by Kenny Endo from the album Eternal Energy. Learn more about Kenny and his music, as well as his traditional and contemporary Japanese drumming school, Taiko Center of the Pacific, at kennyendo.com.
Chief of War Episode 5, The Race of the Gods, will air on Friday, August 23rd, and our next podcast episode will be available the following day, Saturday, August 24th, wherever you get your podcasts and at hawaiipublicradio.org/podcasts.
Aloha and thanks so much for listening.
Mahalo and ahui ho. Until next time, pipi holo ka'o.